How do we get more content? More bodies and more money, right?
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Our special guest today is Daniel Cook of Spry Fox, developer of such games as Steambirds and Road Not Taken. Dan also writes a great blog on game design called Lost Garden. Hi, Dan.
Hello there.
How's it going?
I'm doing well. Can I say that I love Nigel's voice?
You can say that.
Thank you.
I feel like he should be doing an episode of Car Talk and we should all be laughing.
That's great. I've been like over the process of like adding more hardware and software trickery to try and make myself sound closer to as good as Nigel, and I never get there.
He's a natural.
The irony of that, of course, is everyone's like, oh, you have this amazing like deep voice for this stuff, but your voice sounds significantly deeper in your head than it does recorded. So whenever I'm listening to myself, when we're like proofing the podcast and stuff, I sound like a chipmunk to me. So the whole thing seems kind of ridiculous.
And to everyone else, they're like, wow, Nigel sounds great. So our topic today is content-focused games, which is not the term I used to kind of describe it when I was first talking to Dan, but it was actually kind of a term of his that I think really describes the type of games that I'm thinking about and the trade-offs that I sort of want to talk about. This was all kicked off by a blog post, which I'll link up, from a couple months ago that Dan wrote. It was titled How Game Forms Are Shaped by Their Environment. But a lot of the content of that, there's actually a few kind of interesting subtopics in this article. But the one that kind of stuck out to me was just sort of this discussion as a sort of genre or a game form of these games that he calls content-focused games, and has a couple kind of bullet points he puts out, like a focus on evocative content, light use of systems, meaning like kind of more focused on content than like gameplay systems, and being relatively short. And so if anyone has played, like Gone Home is like a really extreme example of one of these, Dear Esther, Stanley Parable, or even maybe to some degree a game like Heavy Rain, even though they're not necessarily short, but they're like very content oriented. So I want to kind of dig into that. What was it? Is there anything in particular, Dan, that triggered your fascination with this particular topic, or is it just kind of something that had been brewing for a long time?
It's something that's been brewing for a long time. One of the things I've been looking at, I mean, we're a small developer. We don't have a lot of money. We don't have a lot of time. One thing I'm always looking at is, how do you develop games efficiently? How do you make a wonderful game that doesn't take $50 million and 200 people working for 4 years?
That's a great ideal.
If you're an indie developer, it's one of those things that, maybe we should look into that.
Yeah.
A lot of this idea about content-focused games actually came about from watching this escalating cost curve that started to hit the industry from the 90s onward. So we started to get fancier graphics, 24-bit graphics, better animation. There was a move to 3D. And I started to see the style of design that companies were doing was changing because of the risks involved with content versus mechanics.
And this is indie games or indie studios in particular, or maybe especially.
This wasn't back then. There wasn't the concept of indie studios. This was there was really only considered to be one game industry, and the whole industry was kind of riding this cost curve up like a rocket ship. So you were seeing. I really got into games probably around like 92, 93. So I was sort of a late entrant into it, because it had still been going on for, you know, a while before that. But, you know, I saw games go from, they were basically small team projects. Like if you look at a lot of the old adventure games and a lot of the classics that we think about, they might have had a team of 5 to 20 people.
Oh yeah, if you think about game budget and team size and amount of like person hours that go into them, every game from the 80s would now be considered an indie game.
Exactly.
Every single one.
And so like, how did we go from this sort of like, oh, every game's an indie game. Indies, you know, people back then were, they didn't even consider themselves gamers. There wasn't the concept of being a gamer. You were just this crazy person operating on the edge of society and probably not taking enough baths, who happened to know art, who happened to know programming, who happened to know hardware. And you were doing this wild renaissance activity of making games, which everyone thought was useless. So a lot of that indie spirit was that entrepreneurial spirit that started the entire game industry. And I really respected that. I thought that was an amazing thing. And so I was curious why it was being lost, why it was going away.
And we've touched on this a little bit, especially the transition into 3D, which I think was one of the big driving forces of this, where suddenly the amount of work, you know, the programming side of the of games has always been fairly variable depending on how ambitious your game is and how many unique systems or features or graphics elements you're going to have that other games don't necessarily have. But the content side of doing everything from level design to animation to creating models and things like that, just the cost of creating a 3D world is more than, you know, 2D to 3D is not a 50% increase in content cost.
No, it ended up being like a 2 to 10 times increase in costs. So you suddenly had these teams that were expecting, oh, we can do another game and it's probably going to cost us maybe 20, 50% more. And they were finding out that they needed to double or quadruple their budgets in order to make the game. And they weren't necessarily selling double or quadruple the number of copies. So they had to adapt a little bit to that.
Right. So the adaptations that we've seen, I mean, obviously some companies have not as much responded to this, and they're still just building these super complicated games that, well, I mean, look at something, our favorite thing that we keep bringing up and we'll make fun of until it comes out and is potentially lives up to its hype, but Destiny, this $500 million MMO shooter, RPG, every genre, everything to everyone sort of game, like obviously they're going, okay, whatever, we're going to take all the risk and we're going to put all the money in because we're confident that we're going to make that back. But there's a lot of people who are reacting to that increased cost by changing the way that their games are made. And this category of game is an example of that.
Right. And Destiny's on the high end. They're still an example of a team that's ridden that cost curve all the way up, all the way from the 90s onward, right? And now they're, you know, they'll be probably spending, you know, $250 million or whatever on making a single game, which is kind of crazy thing to think about.
I believe that actually they did spend $500 million. That's not just like a number out of nowhere. That probably includes marketing though, but still, like, really, $500 million. So they're going on and making us look bad. And in the meantime, we have some developers like Fulbright doing a game like Gone Home, where a lot of the really big things that are risky and expensive to an indie developer, like having to do a whole bunch of character animations and motion capture, they, you know, see a game genre, which is, if anyone hasn't played Gone Home or some things like Dear Esther or Stanley Parable, these are games where basically it's a first person and they use a shooter engine, like Half-Life engine or Unreal or whatever it is. But the only character that you see, or you don't see any characters, because in a first-person shooter, you don't generally see yourself, and so you don't have to animate you, and so you just explore a world, and there's zero or few animations, which is it fair? I don't know. Maybe Nigel will know. He's done more AAA games. Is it fair to say that the biggest, like, cost as far as, like, man or person hours is animation in a big game?
Yeah, I think that's pretty reasonable to say. There's probably some games where the worlds are big enough that, you know, that the animation kind of reusable enough that the world starts to get up there. Like, I don't know, for something like Assassin's Creed, how complicated their world pipeline is. But certainly I think for any, you know, any, what we think of as a modern character focused kind of game, like the animation is a huge portion of the cost, because there's, you know, there's so much that goes into it in terms of artists and mocap time and all these other things. And it's something that's difficult to get around once you've made the decision to have characters in your game, right? Something like world art is way more amenable to being stylistically downgraded in ways that, you know, where you say, well, we're going to take an art style that's going to simplify things for us. You know, world art is pretty amenable to that sort of thing, and character animation is less so, because bad character animation tends to look unnatural as opposed to looking like a stylistic choice.
Yeah, maybe stylized character animation might almost be harder sometimes, I would imagine. So there's definitely technical things that you can sort of do to make these games cheaper. But this specific type of like content focused game is making this trade off of putting their time, their limited, you know, indie development budget, or I mean, any game has a limited budget, but putting their limited budget of time into content rather than systems. So do you want to, and you, this was in your, so Full Indie is a conference that's here in Vancouver, Indie Development Conference, that I happened to see Dan speak at on Sunday, 3 days ago. And this was in your talk a little bit, Dan. Do you want to kind of broach that topic of the systems and what we mean when we say systems versus content?
Sure. So systems are sort of these mechanical structures within the game. They tend to be interactive. Usually they tend to have some exchange of resources. States tend to change quite a bit. There's various feedback loops, either positive or negative feedback loops. There's a wonderful book on a system called Machinations by a fellow named Joris Dormans. That's well worth looking up. He did a book called Advanced Game Design, and it talks about, like, well, how does the internal economies of all these different, you know, stateful mechanisms interact with one another? And systems design is really kind of at the heart of almost every single game that's out there. Almost all games have systems design to one degree or another. Content is more, it tends to be static. It tends to be something that sort of, you can think of it as sort of pre-digested experiences. So it's something that someone's like thought about and put down. Like a movie is a form of content. Writing is a form of content. And these different structures, you know, a system or a piece of content, have different economic attributes. And those economic attributes are really what end up making the decisions so meaningful about what you put into your game. So just to take a small step back here, you can think of almost every single game as a die, like like some dice that you're rolling, and it's a really simple black box engine. So I've got my game, and I roll my dice, and there's a probability that the game is going to be financially successful, and there's a probability that it is going to fail, and so there's risk associated with that game. There's a chance of success, a chance of failure, and what you're trying to do as a game developer is you're saying, I want to minimize the risk and hopefully maximize the potential outcomes. One of your big risks is cost. If you have a super, super high cost and a low chance that your game is going to be a success, then you're kind of putting a lot on the line, right? You're like, oh, I spent, you know, if Destiny's a big bet. I don't know if it's that risky of a bet. Because they're spending that marketing to, you know, as propaganda to convince people to buy it, but it's basically, if that was an indie game, and let's say you make an indie game and you spend $11 million on it, and you only have a 1 in 20 chance of success, you know, that's sort of like a little bit crazy, right?
Especially when you consider your odds of making 20, like if you 1 in 20 chance of success, and it's, you also have to weigh what's the chance of you making 20 times what you invested, which is probably almost zero if you are making any. Like maybe you'll make $200 million on your, if you made Minecraft, but you probably didn't make Minecraft. You probably made a pretty good game.
Yeah. So then as a developer, you're saying to yourself, okay, how do I reduce costs? How do I reduce risk? And then when you look at those two pieces, you look at that, systems design and you look at content design, and you notice they have some interesting little properties from an economic perspective. Systems design is really difficult to get right. It is highly uncertain, especially if you're doing innovative or inventive systems design. Like that's kind of what we work on. We try to say, hey, let's invent brand new mechanics that the world has never seen before. And we go off into our little, hole with just a couple of us, and we bang on little prototypes for ages. And, there's like a 1 in 100 chance we'll come up with something at the end of, a month. And that's just, that's what we do. That's what we're skilled at. But still, if you are a bean counter and you're looking at that, it's like, wait, you want me to give you money and there's only a 1 in 100 chance you're going to do anything that I can sell. So it's kind of, there's almost this all or nothing aspect to systems design that can be really, really, really scary.
Because you could make 20 prototypes and none of them will be fun. And actually, even if one of those 20 is fun, it could not be fun enough to hold up a game. It might just be a subpart of a game or a mini game or a side thing. But once you dig, you might find it, because it has to both be fun enough as like a core thing to be doing repeatedly, but also deep enough that you can build a game around it.
Right? Exactly. That's the horrible thing about game mechanics is, unlike many types of media, like a song or a movie, they cannot work. They can break. You can have someone play it and they're like, I totally don't understand this. And 100% of people just bounce right off this thing that you're making and just not even engage with it in the least. They don't even figure out the button to turn it on, right? That there's a lot of like functional risk in doing systems design.
Right. But the potential reward can be, like, you can get very lucky with systems design. And have you ever played Letterpress?
Oh, that's a great example.
Yeah, so Letterpress, if anyone who hasn't played it, like, free, so you should just get it. As an iOS game, it's a word sort of crosswordy, Tetris-y type multiplayer game. And once you see it, you could instantly just recreate it. Or Threes is another example. You could completely recreate these games because they're a system mostly. The kind of novel thing is a system that you maybe haven't exactly seen in that combination before. Getting to that system, if that's the very first one that you immediately come up with, then, wow, you just got really lucky. In a maybe small amount of time, you devised this system that makes like a whole game can stand on that could potentially be successful. So that's like some of the allure. Like when I think about, especially when I was first in the early stages of thinking about game design, the thing that excited me the most was like a Eureka system idea that like, what if you had a puzzle game where you had whatever, like musical notes that go in columns, and like you sort of have this kind of beginning of an idea and you want to prototype it, because if it's really, really fun and it just works, then you kind of, it's not like you hit a gold mine, but you can get a really big reward if a whole game can stand on the system that you...
And that's the fascinating thing. Like one of the areas we focus on is evergreen games that can be played for hundreds of hours, thousands of hours, years, hopefully. These type of games are immensely rewarding long term. You look at a game like Tetris, and Tetris is played, decades after it was invented. So there's another metric you can think of there, which is sort of like kind of the bang for buck metric. It's like, I spent X number of months or weeks prototyping and working on this game, and that was my cost. However, I ended up creating thousands of hours of content that makes people very, very happy. And it's like, wow, that's a really good value proposition. Now we talk about value proposition, you start going into content as what are the attributes of content.
One more point on the system design stuff before we move on to content.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's sort of deceptive about that kind of systemic design is that the really good examples of it almost seem like these sort of found objects, right? That once you're shown the gameplay of something like Tetris, it's like, oh, well, that's so obvious and so simple and so beautiful. Like, it's not, it doesn't seem like someone spent hours, days, weeks, months prototyping it and polishing off every little edge and trying every little thing. It just seems like, oh, well, that was always there waiting to be discovered. And once it's been discovered, it, you know, the form of it is very simple, which I think that's one of the things that the, at the heart of the riskiness of it is, it's easy to get in that mindset of, oh, well, I can discover this thing easily because the final forms of the ideas seem so simple on the surface.
Yeah, I'm sure there's 100, I mean, there at least could have easily been 100 games that were almost identical to Tetris but sucked. Like, oh, it's like Tetris, but you, the columns disappear instead of the rows when you complete them or something. I don't know. Like, you can, and that would not work at all, actually, now that I think about it. You know what I mean? Like, you can think of subtle variations to something that seems obvious as soon as you see it that just don't work.
Yeah. It's we've had an interesting experience with this. We made a game called Triple Town, which is one of these sort of evergreen sort of titles. And the basic change to the mechanics is you put objects down on the board, and instead of them disappearing when you get a set, they combine into a new object. So it's really sort of a crafting strategy game at its core. And what's been fascinating about it is there's some parts to it that are intentionally there, like there's bears in it that randomize the board ever so slightly and allow you to have almost like a territory capture aspect to the game. And a lot of the people who have copied the game leave some of these things out, and or they do their own variations on the rules. And what's interesting is they're dramatically less fun to play.
For reasons that aren't obvious unless you were the one who figured out those lessons.
Exactly.
We talked about that back when we were talking about threes, because I think it's got another great example of that, that almost all of the clones of it, like the 2048 and, you know, all that series, I think miss out on the thing that makes threes fun and challenging, which is the initial one and two joined to a three rather than in all the other games, all the tiles are sort of symmetrical mm-hmm. in a way that they're not in threes. And that thing is what makes threes so much better than all those other games.
Yeah, and again, it's and unfortunately, there were some market issues for threes in that it's really hard to compete against free. But that's a totally separate topic than the invention side of stuff.
So the you're kind of going to start into the contrast to spending time on building systems, which is spending time on building content.
Yes. So content's fascinating because content can be good, okay, bad, but it almost always works at some level. It's very, very hard to make content that is completely and utterly broken. And so, for example, I can paint a picture and still get an emotional response out of a certain percentage of the population. There's a lot of bad art out there that actually will actually have a response to bad art because it is bad art. So it's working on some functional level, even though it's probably not maybe evoking like beauty as we hoped. It's still doing something to us, right?
It's getting a reaction and it's conveying something.
Yeah, and the reason that works is a lot of the content of art isn't necessarily in the stimuli it provides. It's actually in the brain of the person viewing it. So we're this giant bundle of basically like neural networks, right? And we've got memories stored up and everything's got these neurons that are just on the edge of cascading into firing and activating and lighting up our brains in interesting ways. Have you ever seen one of these old penny arcade machines that you put a coin in it and it piles up other coins?
Oh,
There's a pusher. And then eventually,
you fling the coin onto the pile.
Yes, and then eventually, you get that one last coin in just the right spot, and it pushes it, and there's this whole cascade of coins down. Our brain is kind of set up like that, and when we're going through life, we're kind of accumulating all these experiences and all these like emotional payloads that are being burned into our brain. I had a friend who was insanely scared of plants. At one point, I'm not really making fun of her, but this, it sort of illustrates how the brain works a little bit. At one point when she was a child, she was chased by her aunt, and her aunt thought she was playing this nice game of hide and seek, but the girl was basically chased through this sort of like greenhouse full of dangling plants. And she had this utter fear that she was being chased and the aunt would not stop chasing her and she was going to get caught. And so now this is sort of like trigger in her brain that whenever she sees plants, particularly long dangling plants, she has this fear, this anxiety that wells up and like overwhelms her entire body. And it's a phobia. And that's sort of an extreme example of how our brains operate.
But if you built a game that had dangling scary plants that were going after you, then at least for her, your game would cash out all the emotional stuff that has already been built into her brain with a pretty small stimulus that produces this huge emotional response.
Exactly.
Terror.
Yes.
You can do that on purpose, even in art, if you construct it carefully enough, if you set things up right. One of the best examples of that I've ever encountered is the movie The Blair Witch Project, which I'm about to completely spoil for anyone who hasn't seen this 15-year-old movie yet. But the final shot of that movie is a great example of that, because the final shot of the movie is basically someone with a camera walking into a room and seeing a guy standing in the corner of that room facing the wall. And that's the end of the movie. That's like the capstone shot of the whole thing. And it's something that if you showed it to someone out of context, they wouldn't possibly be at all freaked out by it. But in context, in the movie, it's actually quite scary because they've set up an entire story behind what this guy standing in the corner facing the wall like means. And they've constructed something. They've turned a very visually simple thing and something that's not scary at all out of context into being extremely scary in context.
And that's great when that happens. You know, it's sort of like you're preloading the brain with these emotional responses.
I've seen an author talk about that in terms of like putting coins into the piggy bank. Like a lot of the things you do in narrative and in content of preparing the reader or player for an event, like let's say a cherished character is going to die. Every time that character does something that makes you cherish them, you're putting a coin into the piggy bank of how emotionally charged it'll be when they sacrifice themselves or whatever.
Right. And a lot of that ties into like sort of, I think of them as eternal truths. You know, when we're talking about art, we often talk about like, oh, you know, this art suggests an eternal truth. And really those eternal truths are things like family. Most people have had families. So we've already had a whole bunch of emotional tokens in our piggy bank when it comes to the idea of family. And so when art references that, it's sort of like, it's a gold mine, right? It's like, oh, of course you're going to have an emotional response if I do something about your father dying, you know? Suddenly it's like, oh, you know, of course it's going to hit you.
Because it's something everyone has already thought about.
It's something that everyone's already thought about, or they've had friends who have had that experience, or they've seen other references to that experience. And so it's kind of a lot of these, you know, universal truths or eternal truths are really just another phrase for common emotional experiences.
And iterating that content is much more a known thing. So when I say iterating, like improving continually, so you can, let's say your goal for a game is to create an emotional reaction for the players around family. And you can create a set of content, you know, levels, characters, music. Music is such a huge part of this. Music and all these sort of things to try and get that. And then you can play test it and you get feedback from people and like, how do you feel about this? What do you think about this? And kind of gauge the reaction, or even just playing it yourself, you get a sense of, well, it was close, but it was missing these things in the way that you would edit a book. And you can sort of iterate and improve in a particular direction by improving certain pieces of content or adding things. Whereas with a systems-based thing where you could create a game like The Sims, where anyone could kind of do everything, but with the hope that eventually people will find attachment to their Sims. But if they don't, you might not be able to do anything about it.
Right, right. And so it ends up content has this sort of inherently lower risk. We've been doing it for a while. There's a large population of people who aren't necessarily trained in systems thinking, but they're trained from an early age in writing, in telling stories. It's a very age-old sort of aspect of culture. And so we're good at it. You can do it at relatively low risk. Now, there's an inherent risk in content, which is because it relies so heavily on the contents of other people's brains, that as soon as you start getting overly specialized in what you're talking about, there's a chance that it may not resonate, right?
And the more interesting the thing that you do is, the higher that risk is.
Yes.
Often.
Yes. So you'll often see like a lot of the popular art tends to stick to pretty general themes, pretty common themes. You know, it's like there's a disaster about to happen, or there's a like even something like Gone Home, which is like arriving at an empty house. We've probably all had that experience, and that's a little narrower than more popular topics. But even something as specific as that, it is an experience that we've all had, and it's like, oh, there's kind of that uneasy feeling about getting to an empty house, you know, and being in an empty house in a storm. Have you guys ever felt that before?
Yeah, definitely. I had that being in an empty house evoked from my previous history when I was playing the game.
Yeah, it's so there's a lower risk to it. Now, the other interesting thing about content is, going back to the economic perspective, is content has a linear cost of production. So to do 1 minute of content is roughly the same cost as doing that second minute of content. So if you want to make 5 minutes of content, you basically take how much it costs you to make 1 minute and you multiply it by five. So it's a very predictable thing, right? Which is if you're trying to minimize risk, is kind of exciting.
Yeah, and like indie developers aren't the only ones who exploit that to minimize risk. I mean, that's a huge part of how the games that are chasing that cost curve have grown as well. If you look at a game team from like 15 years ago to now, the game team size might be quadruple or quintuple what it was in terms of personnel versus 15 or 20 years ago. But it's not that every area has quintupled its size. It's like, you know, maybe you've got 50% more programmers or double the number of programmers, and maybe you've got, you know, 50% more or double the number of game system designers. But what you've got is you've got quintuple the number of world artists and, you know, like level layout artists and stuff like that. Like, they've tried to increase the load in those areas that are low risk and easy to estimate. And the easy to estimate thing is a huge thing as well. You know, that's something that I definitely noticed in my time working on those kinds of big games, is that, you know, you say to the programmers, like, all right, here's our task list. Give me an estimate for each item on that. And, you know, programmers will underestimate stuff, and they'll, you know, everything will be wrong by a little bit, but then there'll be those few things that are like two orders of magnitude wrong, right? Where they say like, oh yeah, getting this system is going to take us a week, and it actually took a year and a half, right? whereas artists never get it that wrong, right? If you say to you know, like an NIS animator. Okay, we have, you know, we have our script for the NIS here. It's going to be three characters, and it's going to be, you know, 3.5 minutes of animation that you need to do. How long are you, is it going to take for that? Yeah, even if they get optimistic too and say like, oh, it'll take 2 weeks, and it actually takes 2 weeks and 2 days, it's never going to take a month. You know, they're gonna underestimate by reasonable amounts that people get out of being over optimistic, not like order of magnitude mistakes on just getting wrong how hard the thing is.
Something in that sort of vein, when we're talking about adding content versus systems into a game, actually was the, I think the first thing that originally brought me to being aware of your blog, maybe 4 years ago, which was this article about Steambirds, which was one of your games from some time ago, and about this trade-off in between designed levels and generated levels.
Yes. Yeah. The basic idea there was we wanted to, again, create an evergreen game that had lots and lots of levels. And to make a good random procedural map generator with all the waves coming in and everything balanced and tuned, there's actually this huge upfront cost to get that right. But then once you've done that, the marginal cost drops off dramatically, and you can create as many levels as you want, right? If we had done handcrafted levels, we actually probably could have got two or three levels going relatively quickly. In fact, for the very first version of Steambirds, it was all handcrafted levels. But there were only about 10 of those levels in total. And at a certain point, those two curves kind of cross. You've got a linear curve going up, and you've got a curve with an inverse exponential curve where it's diminishing over time. And at a certain amount of content, the procedural is a far better investment. Which is I think one reason why you're seeing indies doing so much with procedural generation. When they're like, we need to make a big game that's interesting and exciting for a long period of time. They can't compete with a Destiny or, you know, one of these large AAA games that basically says, well, how do we get more content? More bodies and more money, right? Then no, it says, let's be smart and make a procedural system instead.
And that's where you get games like I don't think Nigel's played. Have you played Don't Starve, or at least seen Don't
Starve? No, I haven't played that yet.
So this is a sort of, and really any roguelike, this big popularity in the last 5 years of quote unquote roguelike games, basically where you play them repeatedly and you die repeatedly and each time is different. And that's like mostly a systems-based thing. Like, there's content in that you might encounter certain objects or enemies or items or whatever, but effectively, the development of the game is improving the thing that generates that stuff and increasing the number of things it can generate.
Yeah. We had a wonderful moment. It's not a wonderful moment. It's a disastrous moment, and I'm laughing because clowns are sad people. We had a difficulty spike in the levels that are being generated in our game Road Not Taken. And so we're getting back these reviews that say, this is a horrible, deeply flawed game because there's like all this, you know, they like use these cheap difficulty tricks and so on and so forth. And I was trying to figure out what was going on. And essentially in a certain percentage of rooms, the density spikes in a way that it shouldn't.
This is a bug.
It's not necessarily a bug. It's a one of the probably, you know, 500, 600 variables that I set a little too low.
Right.
And then you've got, you know, most of the levels that I go through don't have this problem, but, and some people have mentioned it, but, you know, whether it was a common thing or not, but it ended up like people really, really latched onto it as an important issue, which is the benefit of playtesting.
Yeah, I saw the review. I haven't had a chance I bought the game, but I haven't had a chance to play it yet. The review I read was the Ars Technica one, which I'm not sure in the scheme. Maybe I'll actually play the game, find a review that I think fits my feeling of the game before I link it, before the show goes up. But he described it as the game was really fun and it was really deep. I didn't describe it as being broken, but he described the difficulty curve as sometimes being unexpectedly spiky.
It is.
And that's probably the same issue.
It is. And so in a content-based game, and this has happened in content-based games, you may be faced with like 6 to 12 months of reworking all your levels in order to fix that issue. Because somewhere along the planning curve, when you were hand laying down the specific monsters at the specific points, you made the game too difficult. And in this game, I realized, oh, it's a 5-minute fix, and I can just tweak this variable to like adjust that difficulty curve.
So there'll be an update on Steam by the time I play the game.
At some point here, we will put an update out. I want to do a little more tuning, but yes.
Sure.
And that to me is one of the miraculous things about procedural content is if you look at it as code, it's something that you can refactor, you know, and the refactor, you know, changes the algorithm and suddenly you've changed your entire game within, you know, with one or two lines. And in content-based games, that's never the case.
You're taking that risk back on though that content games are getting away from, right? Is the more systems you put in, the more chance there is that something's going to go wrong with one of the systems, as is that case. And you walk that line with procedural content of, yeah, if we get the procedural content generation right, we can generate way more content than we could ever possibly hope to make through conventional content generation means, but maybe you won't. Maybe you'll get the generation algorithm slightly wrong in a way that that messes up the difficulty curve.
Right.
And yeah, you can, you know, if it's something simple like that, you can fix it if everything else is sort of firing on all cylinders. But it's back to that sort of fundamental risk of what if you try the thing and it's just not fun? You know, if you're taking the systemic approach of building everything at a micro detail.
Because the content-focused game with the bad difficulty curve, you could still be like, well, you know, we'll just ship it and it still has this bad difficulty curve. Whereas if your systemic game has some weird thing where, you know, in 1% of all cases, the world flips inside out and lights on fire or something, then that's just kind of a consequence of your crazy.
Well, and a lot of the canonical, you know, kind of content focused games of the type that we've been talking about, the like first person story exploration kind of games, don't even really have a difficulty curve. You know, at worst, they've got some choke points where you cannot figure the thing out, right? If you say, oh, well, I need to unlock this door and I missed the thing that I need in order to unlock that door to progress to the next story area, like you can get permanently stuck, but it's usually not a situation where there's some skillful task you need to perform that's harder to do than the skills that you've developed so far in the game, the same way you do in a more gameplay focused systemic kind of game.
Well, in my experience, actually, the games where I've hit the worst unexpected difficulty ramps are ones that have even more systems, like RPG type games that let me choose my own path. Like we often complain about Deus Ex, or any game that lets you like make a character of various types, then you're like, okay, I'm going to be the stealthy guy. And then suddenly you end up in a battle where it's like, you can't stealth around me. I'm going to just constantly shoot at you. And you have to suddenly learn everything you were supposed to have learned all game about shooting back all in one level.
Yeah. Or you just get the, you know, the wrong loadout because that's, you know, that's part of the game. Like that's, you know, Deus Ex, definitely I encountered that with. We talked about that before. I've encountered that with Hearthstone. I've been playing a fair bit of that the last little while. And, you know, I'd get like my daily missions occasionally that would be like, okay, win 5 games as one of these 2 characters. And they weren't characters that I played as much. And so I'd make a deck and just get like butchered 5 times in a row and then swap out like 2 cards in the deck and suddenly be successful because, you know, particular patterns of strength and weakness can be so dependent on exactly what loadout you've got. And sometimes it can take a while to figure out what those problems are. And Hearthstone's kind of a game that's all about that, like figuring out what those loadouts are. So it isn't frustrating, but in something like Deus Ex Human Revolution, that was intensely frustrating.
I think this is actually one of the brilliant things that's happened with indie content-based games is they've realized that by reducing the systems risk almost entirely, what they can do is they can create a game that is almost purely about content delivery. Over the past, I don't know, 15, 20 years, 30 years, really over, if you take into account everything, we've sort of developed this language of storytelling through games. And each one of these content-based games is essentially taking sort of one of those well-proven, well-trodden systems, the voiceover, the click on an item to see additional information, these very, very standard, like almost adventure game-like techniques. And they're basically saying, look, they're really low risk. You're not going to break them. They have no difficulty associated with them whatsoever. Like Dear Esther is walking with a voiceover, right? It's very, very difficult to break. And they've turned and they've said, look, we're going to use those to tell a story. We're going to use them as the equivalent of turning a page in order to feed the user content. And so they reduce their risk. And as long as they keep their game short, they keep their costs down and predictable, which is really a nice point on the cost side of making an indie game.
The risk that they're taking on, and the thing that I find kind of frustrating about these games, like I'm not in general a huge fan of the genre, is that by making that choice and saying we're going to make it all about the story, you've definitely got to up your game story-wise compared to other video games. Like, video games have gotten away with the story being relatively unimportant and kind of shoddily thrown together and told through not great narrative techniques, because that's not, for the most part, what video games are about. As long as the gameplay is there, you know, you can overlook flaws in the storytelling. Whereas by shifting the focus to the story, the flaws can start becoming more apparent. And that, you know, that's the thing. I played, I don't know, maybe half an hour into Dear Esther and just put it down, and I'm probably not going to go back because I just didn't find it interesting enough.
The story didn't
speak to me.
But the story on Dear Esther was like a huge disappointment to me. I actually enjoyed Gone Home because of the story. Another take on this, which is not necessarily narrative in focus, is a game called Monument Valley. Have you played that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we actually had the designer on the show a few weeks ago, and it was
Ken.
Awesome. Yeah, yeah.
The wonderful thing about Monument Valley is it's essentially a gallery show. So you are looking at this gorgeous, gorgeous, I almost think of it as a flip book of art. And the only thing I cared about, I didn't really care about the story. The game mechanics were sort of there at a low cognitive level to keep me moving along. But what really ended up mattering is I got to see a beautiful picture I could interact with, and then another one, and then another one. It is almost like a coffee table book or something.
In our office at Steam Clock, we actually have a big print of one of the levels on the wall to kind of make the extreme version of their original, or one of the original ideas. They were thinking of, like, can we make a game where every screen is a piece of art? And I think they succeeded.
Yeah, yeah. And the mechanics deliver that art, and that's all they really require functionally from the mechanics, and that works pretty reasonably.
Yeah, I think that what Nigel's point was about the story being more important is true. And like, I agree with both of you in the Dear Esther, the story didn't really do anything for me. And the theme and everything, it's just like, yeah, okay, where's Gone Home? I liked, and Stanley Parable, I thought was amazing. Like, I thought it was quite funny and it was worthwhile. And they're all like mechanically very similar. They're all first person engines or whatever. And the reason that I think that I enjoy those other ones is just because the story is better. But I think that one nice trade-off you get from making a game that's less dependent on game loops and systems is that you don't need to make compromises in the story in order to force the player to do weird encounters and things. Like, for example, pretty much every first-person shooter, the main character has to be a murdering psychopath that just kills everyone to solve all of his problems, because killing people is the game loop. So your story ends up getting weird where it's like, hey, this guy has some bullets. Like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to kill him, as opposed to, like, we need this resource you have. It's like, and everybody you meet will always try to shoot at you in order to keep you from getting the thing, as opposed to being like, you know what, let's sit down and talk about this.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's necessarily that doesn't happen in the story-driven games, though. Like, I definitely am enjoying Gone Home more than I enjoyed Dear Esther. I think, like you say, because the story is just a lot better and a lot more plainly told. But I do find it's got some of those, like, mechanic-y, gamey things kind of get in the way. Is it definitely does feel like, all right, well, I got to check every object. You know, you spend a lot of time like rifling through drawers and picking up objects and looking at them to try and determine if there's anything interesting about them. And there's at least as far as I can tell, there's way more objects in the game than there is story. Like there is incidental objects, which in some ways is a good thing. It makes it feel like a bit more of a real space. But from a game standpoint, it's like, well, I really just want to pick up the next interesting piece of story object. Like the fact that there's these other things that I can pick up that don't advance the story is, you know, it slows the pacing down in a way that isn't great. Like it's not, you know, it's not derailing the whole experience, but it definitely feels, you know, it feels like I should be as my character in that situation, like running around, panicking, flinging open doors, like trying to find the people that I'm expecting to be in this house.
But instead you're looking at every single book on the bookshelf.
I'm wandering from room to room, like checking for notes on all flat surfaces throughout the room and opening all the doors. And
I'd argue that this is content that can really only be delivered to gamers. Raph Koster has this concept of chunking, where you've learned something and you basically like chunk it up into this little thing. The classic example is driving to work. You drive to work, the first day you do it, you're kind of nervous about it. And then the next day that you do it or the next month that you do it, you kind of forget all about it, right? You've done it so often that you don't even, you may not even remember driving to work, right? It's chunked up. It just becomes this automatic process. I think one of the reasons things like Dear Esther and Gone Home actually work is because they're being played by gamers who have chunked up and mastered so fundamentally the basic page-turning interaction that we barely even notice it, right? Like, if I give someone WASD and a mouse look interface, if they're not a gamer, it's going to be a complete and utter disaster.
They're staring at the ceiling by accident, and
yeah, it's a horrible, horrible interface. But gamers have literacy in those conventions, and so therefore they've chunked it up to the point where they don't even notice that it's there. They're like, of course you click on all the objects. What else would you do? Of course you like run around with WASD and you know. The thing where they get upset is that if you don't include the run key. In fact, yeah. One of the most immersion-breaking things about some of these games is they don't include the run key, which is like, wait. Yeah, it's like not being able to bookmark a book. It's like, oh my goodness, why did you do that to me? And that's immersion-breaking, but actually WASD and Mouse Look, not immersion-breaking at all.
To us,
yeah. Yeah, so it's not like we've found some universal new art form. What we do is we have an audience that we've trained on these conventions for the however long since Doom and Quake were about, and we've been desperately trying to tell stories within that mechanical setup, and now we've got an audience that's literate literate at least with those conventions to be able to absorb content.
I do think removing the gamey elements, though, has the potential to even make gamers like think about it more than they would have. You know, very similar mechanics in more shootery games have not distracted me in the same way. Like, I don't feel as bad like checking every cash register and trash can in one of the BioShock games because I know there's going to be useful stuff in them.
That will help you accomplish your objective.
That's going to help me accomplish my goal. Whereas in a more story-driven game, it seems like I can't skip any of those things because I could be missing out on the point, which is the story, right? Whereas in BioShock, you know, you're never going to find like a crucial story piece of information in a trash can. It's if you're low on money or low on health, search all these extraneous things for stuff and you'll find more resources. And if you aren't, you can safely ignore that because you know that's a gamey element. Whereas when you say, all right, you're hunting for the story among all these objects and the objects are not super clearly distinguished. And I mean, part of that might just be in the case of Gone Home that I'm early in the game that, you know, eventually maybe I figure out that, all right, it's always only ever notes that have anything interesting on them. And all of the other objects are just, you know, are just there to provide color in the world. But like right now I'm picking up everything and looking at it.
I think you kind of have
three quarters of the things don't have anything on them.
I picked up 90%. Eventually I'll be like, yeah, okay, more books. Like I'll come back to them if I get stuck or something. But certain categories of objects I stop caring about. And you know, sometimes your character will say stuff like, oh yeah, more empty Coke cans or whatever. Like, and you just like ignore them. But I feel like that it's a good thing in some ways that we are putting a more criticism on these stories that we're going through and thinking about them, like that pressure of us being like, okay, but this is still kind of, you know, maybe a weird narrative thing that my character is doing. This is maybe a little immersion breaking. We'll continue that loop of people making games that are more focused on making a realistic or interesting or engaging narrative. But there was something about that that I had never consciously thought about before, but I had sort of been kind of bothered by, which Dan mentioned in this article. This is kind of the last thing I had on my list of things I wanted to talk about today, is this trick of if your storyline is kind of weird or bizarre or esoteric, then it makes it harder for people to actually voice their criticism of the story. And the way that Dan put it, I'll just quote from this thing. It says, you can implement content that's either vague or open to many interpretations. This means the quality of your content can be lower without anyone being able to concretely describe it as such. And when I read that, I was like, oh my God, that's totally true. You can't complain about the story that you don't understand because you sound like an idiot.
Right, right. There's entire fields of the humanities that are based off this. There's a class of knowledge which is basically opinions. You know, it's like, here's my experience and here's my opinion. What are you going to say about it? You know? And as soon as the work starts to become more personal, you can say whether it impacted you or not, but there's nothing like factual or, you know, there's no observation you can make that says this is wrong. Because there's classes of knowledge that can't be wrong. You know, I'm feeling sad today. No, you're not. You know, that doesn't make any sense. And so by dealing with that type of evocative stimuli, you can, in some ways, you kind of break a lot of the, score this game on 1 through 10 rating system. It's not a valid rating system anymore.
I think the thing that really made me feel the strongest this way, but there's definitely other indie games especially tend to do this, was Sword and Sorcery, which is like maybe a precursor to Monument Valley in this like iPad game where it's 2D and you're moving around. It's a highly stylized world that's very beautiful with great sound. But the storyline in that game is intentionally obtuse. Like people, you talk to people and they just say bizarre things that make almost no sense. And you get a sense that there's like, okay, there's characters, there's these fairies and you have to save them. You don't really know why or where they are or what's going on. But like, that's supposed to be kind of the fun of it. And to me, I just felt dumb for not getting it as opposed to like, but I never really talked to many people about it because people were like, man, I love Sword and Sorcery. And I'd be like, yeah, the music was great. Or like, it looked really cool. But like, I didn't feel as good saying, whereas if I played a game that had a story that like Call of Duty or Revenge of the such and such, that had a story that was just really dumb, then I can easily be like, that story was really dumb because it made no sense when this character did this. Whereas like you can just have a game that has a stamp that says, this is supposed to make no sense. And then you can just kind of be like, well,
the parable that fits for all this is The Emperor's New Clothes. And the fine arts establishment has been going through this for decades. You know, it's like, hey, we're just going to do something that is abstract and there's a bunch of people who have very nice outfits and seem respectable who are saying it's good. And in fact, people are collecting the work and spending millions of dollars on it. So how can you say it's bad?
There's also a certain amount of just if you can recognize the sort of moments that are going to be evocative in isolation and use them well. It doesn't even necessarily have to be a thing of that there's nothing there, that there's real things there, but they aren't coherent. And if you move fast enough, you can stop people from realizing that. And I think Call of Duty is actually kind of an interesting example that way, in that it's a AAA, seemingly fairly story-driven game that I think actually does that to a certain degree, is a lot of the story elements don't make a whole lot of sense, but they're cool, you know, like they're cool in the way that like Michael Bay action scenes are cool, of there's awesome stuff going on and, you know, there's crazy things happening and iconic locations are being destroyed. And it's, you know, it's neat, it's evocative. And if you examine how everything fits together, it doesn't always fit together great. But if you move fast enough, people sometimes will be willing to overlook that, often be willing to overlook it if you pack in enough action and excitement. I think Monument Valley does some of that same sort of stuff, is there's some, you know, there's some plot there. And if you put the plot out on the table and try and stitch it together and figure out what actually happened here, it doesn't make a whole bunch of sense, but all of the individual moments that make up the plot are kind of evocative, you know, like getting to the bottom of the descent level and there's all these things that look like there are coffins there. That's like a cool reveal. It doesn't matter that you don't understand exactly why the coffins are there and who built the coffins if everyone died out and what all that means. It's like, yeah, getting to the bottom of this dungeon and suddenly the lights come on and there's a whole bunch of coffins there. Like, that's just kind of a neat, evocative moment in isolation.
So nonsense is okay as long as it's not slow nonsense. And I think I would agree with that.
Yeah. It's actually a fascinating shift that's happening. We're kind of moving from an industry that was perhaps more math, science, technocratic sort of focused, and not completely though. It's always been a mixture over the years, but it was at least people who had both art and science in their blood. And now with it's probably not surprising that things like Dear Esther and Stanley Parable are coming out of things like the mod scene, which are, you know, tools focused, content focused, you know, writing, level design, more about like, it's not necessarily a science driven activity. It's much more of an art driven activity.
And yeah, well, as the tools get better, people that don't have the technological background to have built something like that 20 years ago can do it now, right? Someone who's an artist can make a game by themselves, which is something you just couldn't, you know, you couldn't do. You needed that technology 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and, you know, the tools just hadn't advanced enough. Whereas now you know, you can go and build something like that just if you have an artistic sense, not having to have the technical skills.
And I think there's a very fascinating thing that's happened. When I look at the writing about games that's going on, like as a craft, as a form that we're moving forward, the art side of writing has exploded. You know, you can't turn around without getting some sort of like, you know, how to tell story. Here's how we did this art focused game. Here's how I did this writing. Here's a criticism from a humanities perspective on these type of games. That type of writing seems to be extraordinarily prevalent now. But it feels to me that like the systems discussion has actually stagnated a bit. It was always moving forward slowly because there aren't a ton of systems thinkers out there in the world. But now like it's a topic that I worry about, that we're not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily have a community around it that's pushing, hey, like kind of like a math department or something of that sort that says, hey, let's talk about systems and figure out how we can advance systems design. I'm not sure if that's happening to the same degree.
Well, let's keep it alive. Let's make it happen. So how can people find more about you and your games, Dan?
You can go to our website, spryfox.com. That's spry, like S-P-R-Y. Or you can go to my website where I have my game design articles, lostgarden.com. Our games are on Steam. You can get Triple Town and Road Not Taken up on Steam. And I think you can actually download Road Not Taken for free on PlayStation 4 if you have a PS Plus account.
Awesome. So if anyone was on the fence about getting a PS4, then go get one today and you get a free copy.
I think Steam may be the cheaper option at that point.
Well, yeah, but then you get a PS4 and you can play other awesome games. So
that's true.
I haven't played Triple Town or Road Not Taken, but I have played Steamberg and would strongly recommend it. I really enjoyed it. And I think anyone who does like system-y games would definitely enjoy it. It's very much a gameplay focused game in a really wonderful way.
Awesome. I will second that. Thanks for listening, everybody. We always want to know what you think. So please give us some feedback either by sending us an email, hello@upup.fm, or on the iTunes store, you can give us a rating or some feedback. So thanks a lot and see you next week. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about The Road Not Taken? Because we sort of touched on it a little bit, but I don't feel like people who were listening to this show maybe have yet gotten a sense of what the game is like.
Sure. So Road Not Taken is a puzzle roguelike. So it's you are a ranger and there are children who are lost in a wintry forest and you're trying to rescue them. All the levels in the forest are procedurally generated, the mechanics are, instead of killing things, you're more like sort of rearranging the objects in the forest in order to break through different barriers to get deeper and deeper into the forest.
And it's like iterative, like you play as deep as you can, and then that's like one season, and then next winter you'll play as deep as you can, and it sort of repeats with more sophisticated gameplay each time, and like the roguelike kind of, that's the what the roguelike element is.
Yes, right? Yeah. And it has permadeath, so it's a very difficult game, which a lot of people are surprised by. They're like, "Oh, it looks kind of cute,"
but
we were kind of going for this, kind of dark fairy tale type thing where it looks cute and then it kicks your ass. So it is. That's probably one of the bigger surprises that people have.
Is there a difficulty setting, or is it always on a set on?
It's always on high. Now, what's interesting about it is the game is not necessarily all that hard, but all the objects in the game have their own behaviors. And once you learn the behaviors, you're like, oh, that makes sense. I can deal with that pretty easily every single time. However, if you haven't learned the behaviors, you're like, oh my God, this is the most challenging thing ever. And then something clicks. So we were kind of going for that, like that moment of understanding where you're leveling up, but not necessarily by getting more hit points, but you're leveling up by actually improving your brain.
Which is awesome. Yeah. That's like the StarCraft way of leveling up.
Yes, yes, the StarCraft way.
Or in my case, never get leveling up and always sucking.
That can happen too. That's actually one of the problems with that particular technique.
Yeah, but my sense was that, like from your description in the review that I read, was that unlike StarCraft, if you play The Road Not Taken, you will learn and you will get better. One of the reviews I was seeing was like one of the main, like he called it like a game of grief or something like that, because you would often encounter circumstances where he would learn something and be like, oh, I wish I already knew that. And then he can apply it in the future. But
right. It's also a bit of an emotional game if you're looking for that. It deals with ideas of aging and not having children and like sort of some of the tragedies that can happen. Your character actually only has a 15-year lifespan. And so you can, there's kind of a light, almost dating sim aspect to it. So you can build up relationships with some of the characters in the village And, you know, you fall in love, you get married, people can get sick, you know,
wow,
jealousy.
I totally did not expect any of those things from the screenshots at all.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's very interesting. So that makes me want to ask, like, the more I learn about the game, the more surprised I am as to what, like, game. So when you mentioned dating sim aspects, the permadeath, like, I noticed the permadeath from the trailer, like, it was quite put a point on, like, you see the gravestones repeatedly, and you're like, okay, there's permadeath, I get that.
We had to sell that, because it wasn't obvious to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's something that people get pissed off about if they're not expecting it.
Yeah.
So you have these this cute, fun, beautiful art style, and then this various mix of puzzle and sort of what would be thought of as hardcore, like, permadeath, roguelike elements. Like, as the game sort of launched and you're sort of basking in the glow of having shipped it, what do you think of that decision to make that kind of contrasting art style with gameplay? Do you feel like that was, like, ended up being, like, a good call, or do you kind of, is it a mixed bag?
Anytime you try to do something that's a little different, it's always a mixed bag. I mean, my entire career has been a mixed bag, so I don't tend to mind that too much. It's a game that has a wide range of responses. Some people absolutely get it and they love it. One of the things that I've actually been really happy about with the cute art style is we seem to have a lot more women playing the game.
Oh, that's very cool.
So, like, I've noticed, like the audience for Triple Town was about 50-50 men and women. And so, like, I like having games that are not... I don't know. They're not, like, you know, the Gears of War, like, very strong masculine bro imagery, and so that was an important thing for me, and so I think we have that. What's interesting is a lot of the women playing don't nearly comment on the difficulty as much as the men.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
That's something that completely fascinates me. Like,
the women are tougher.
Yeah, this is a complete gender stereotype, and I apologize, which means I'm going to say something horrible. The men tend to complain more. Like, it's almost like the fact that it's as hard is an affront to their, like, masculinity. I haven't seen the same response from the women playing it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I'm curious where that's coming from. You know,
it's some sort of built-in thing. Like, I'm good at games. I mean, I'm just horribly stereotyping, like, 50% of the population. But you could imagine it coming from a psychological position of someone who perceives themselves as being good at games. And so, if a game is challenging for them, then they see it then as must be a problem with the game.
Right, and that's often what happens. It's like, it's almost a. Do you think it's an internal thing or an external thing? And I think a lot of times people end up feeling when they see something that's difficult, they feel it's an external thing.
Right.
So games like Spelunky and such have done a wonderful job of saying, no, it's an internal thing. And, like, by getting better at this very, very hard activity, you're improving yourself. And that's something perhaps we'll have to figure out how to message.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, like, I keep mentioning this, but the review that I read, seem to get that based on the feedback of you. There's this little catalog of the things you've learned about, and that persists even when you die. And so there's, like, a little map of your personal growth, basically.
Yeah. The book of secrets.
Ah.
There's, like, 200 secrets in the game, and you slowly figure them out as you go along. And basically all the objects in the game, you can see them as a challenge or a problem, or you can see them as an opportunity. They all have multiple layers of behaviors in them. For example, there's some animals that when you first encounter them, they start attacking you, and you're like, oh my goodness, these are such a horrible thing. And then eventually you realize, oh wait, I can cook them. and so you get some of that don't starve survival aspect in there. And suddenly you see them and you're like, I'm so happy I saw that.
Oh, great food.
Yeah. So just because your brain changes, you know, you're like, oh, I learned some additional information. I learned some new skills. It goes from being a horrible thing to a very, very positive thing over the course of, like, a game or two.